Hello, listeners. Welcome to A Writer's World. This is Sean Griffin, a poet and writer who hopes to share some part of that world with you here on KWNK. It's a big subject, and we'll see where it leads. Today's program is entitled Looking Into the Looking Glass on Critics and Others in the Know. But first, a shout out to all of you listeners for tuning in to this, my 50th program. A year and change ago, when Britt and Tom were gracious enough to ask me to do this program, I never dreamt it would have a shelf life beyond a few episodes. Now 50 sojourns into the words and lives of those who make them, I am humbled that this record goes on. Thank you all for taking a few minutes on Sunday afternoons to listen and sometimes accord your thoughts on what was shared. I have an old rule I follow. When I read or hear something that provokes, my first impulse is to wait. If it provokes me deeply, wait longer. This has mostly kept me out of literary trouble, all other kinds not so much, but I digress. Recently, there were two different articles in the literary press that led me to pause. The first, a review of the late critic Harold Bloom's posthumous book, and an obituary for J. Hillis Miller, the Yale proponent and former colleague of Mr. Bloom, of literary deconstruction. Now, lest the listener think they're going to break out in hives upon hearing such a discussion, I assure you nothing of the kind will happen. Rather, I hope to offer another perspective on the literary hijinks that so often are taken as gospel. I have waited long enough to distract myself from the source of my anger. It was obvious the late critic Mr. Bloom and his reviewer loved the literary canon, which means, of course, the great books of the West. Much has been written about this, and I do not want to add to that discussion. What was not so obvious, or more correctly, cleverly disguised, was the smug literary castle that they looked down from. They were literally more books cited than almost anyone could read in a lifetime, and the parallels to other voracious readers, members of their castle, were similarly cited. It was overwhelming to even consider such an undertaking, which was the point. Only an elite few can even hope to acquire such encyclopedic knowledge in their lifetime, and therefore they must share it or dispense it for us to comprehend such depths. This arrogance has permeated much of literature for some time, and sadly it has migrated to and from the universities for the last century. Of course, there is shelter there, room to think and postulate and ruminate over such things as the literary relevance of Middlemarch versus Moby Dick. But here is the rub, and it is a rub for all of us. A bricklayer would not hoard his trade for the lucky few. Neither would most mechanics or chefs. There would be a desire to share what was good and right about the profession, a willingness to gather those who are on the outside looking in, and a concerted effort to welcome into, rather than exclude from, what knowledge was had. Like Regan's trickle-down economics, which trickled right down to the tea and crumpets class, but not much farther, this literary model of building a high rise of favorites keeps the chosen few in and the rest of the reading public out. That's a problem, or as Martin Amis so cogently said, my paraphrase, writing good literature is not a gunny sack race. There is no first place. Up until early last century, people didn't read Melville or Dickinson, and then one day, poof, they were rediscovered. But what of the thousand writers whose voices we still do not know? And what of those we do but somehow miss the invitation to this exclusive club? Not surprisingly, there were many. Among them, one of my favorites of all time, Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. And since we're in South America, Neruda's poetry. You understand where I'm going. The club is outfitted for the clubbers, and sadly, there's a great deal of that going around right now. We've just suffered 4 years of an elitist government that provided, not like Frost, but like a supreme ruler for the ruling few. And the rest were left to grovel. You can say what you want about tax cuts for the rich, but tax cuts for the poor never happen. The parallel lives of literature and the society within which it lives are never separate. They are analogous, and I suspect function with this intention. To leave one in at the expense of many is an economic ideal, a kind of anti-Marxism, meaning I got mine, you get yours. I promise not to alienate you with thought waves. What I am saying is really quite simple. By listening to the tympanum of the high priests of literature, we lose so much. We lose out on the hundreds and hundreds of fine writers whose star did not rise over Manhattan. I recently started a book that was praised by many of this club and cannot find my way past page 50. It reeks of the societal ill of privilege. So when I say these two cultures, literary and societal, are interwoven, it becomes a kind of Hunger Games to see who will win, and that was never the reason for writing books. I don't want to win anything, and most writers I know want to build something so incredibly imagined that it will leave the reader breathless. That is mountain enough to climb. We do not need more mountains, thank you anyway, Mr. Critic and Mr. Reviewer. We need more authenticity, more straight talk, more genuine love of craft that puts process ahead of privilege. But our culture is bound by many definitions that I am unable to embrace, and they limit what can be expressed and by whom. They engender a certain benevolence toward those whose words affirm that benevolence and reject the voices that choose other modes of expression. I remember Roberto Bolaño's novel, By Night in Chile, was about this very subject. Pinochet's literary sycophants were able to remain in the castle. Those who could not praise him were killed or fled Chile during the coup. I am thankful to be living in a time when both of these structures, literary and societal, are being challenged and abraded by new and different ways of doing things. Among writers of color, I am overwhelmed with the veracity of their language. Tommy Orange, Viet Nguyen, Kisi Lehman, and the poets are equally as stunning, Ocean Vuong, Reginald Betts, Natalie Diaz, and Layli Long Soldier, and these are but a few. There are hundreds who are tearing up the literary landscape. Not unlike the protests over last summer tore up the landscape of accepted practice for justice and racism. These confines of literary and cultural taste ebb and flow with the passage of time. One thing that is certain, none of these voices were in Mr. Bloom's canon because, I'm guessing, they were not vetted by the timbre of time, which, of course, translates to they were not white. I know we are blemished as people. I have no truck with that. What disturbs is the intentional view taken by those who are in charge of their castles. And maybe this cannot be helped save by writing which cannot be refuted. The next canon will not be like this one, and hard as it is to imagine, race and justice will not be as it is in this time. We will move forward or we will perish with our privilege. This has been the case for centuries. It is the story of colonization everywhere, and maybe that's what I'm saying. It's time to decolonize literature. Which brings me to my last point, the passage of the late deconstruction prophet J. Hillis Miller. Let me be the first to say I still do not understand literary deconstruction. I think it means something like there is no absolute meaning in text. Words are simply relational, not a part of bigger things from which we derive pleasure or context. And while this may be true or even plausible, it too builds more reasons to keep the castle private. Fortunately, deconstruction fell out of favor when one of its chief avatars was found to have cheated on and never finished his dissertation at Harvard, and before that was a Nazi apologist. Words do have meaning, a lot of meaning. Ask any 7-year-old how important it is to hear, "I love you." Ask the same question of any 50-year-old who has lost a family member to COVID. We cannot accept the reasoning that puts forth such assertions. Sure, there are good books and some great ones, and they are different for all of us. It is ludicrous to assume a pedigree permits such judgment. Damn the castles of influence. They reach deep into our lives and uproot many who would otherwise live to tell stories we may one day need. This concludes our program on A Look Into the Looking Glass, on critics and others in the know. Please join us in the Collective Ether Sphere on the first and third Sundays at 5 p.m. for our next meditation on words, or stream it at kwnkradio.org. And please support your local independent bookstore. In Reno, that's Sundance Books and Music, and in Las Vegas, that's the Writer's Block. They're open, and we need them. Thank you, be safe, and spread a little kindness wherever you are.